It is very good to see everybody here today. We do appreciate the visitors that we have, and we encourage you to stick around for a few minutes after our worship service. Let us know if you have any spiritual needs. We would love to sit down and have a Bible study with you, talk to you about what those needs are, and show you from the Bible only what it is that God asks of you to be saved, to live right with Him, and to live with Him in eternity. Now, occasionally we do like to address some topics that are a little bit more challenging. Some topics that are easy to put away in the closet. Topics that are convenient to ignore. But they're topics that touch our lives in ways that can be very surprising and very sobering. I'm going to talk about addiction today. And this is going to be a two-part series, so we'll address some things today and bring it to a conclusion next Sunday. Most of you know that one of my favorite television shows is Drugs, Inc. on National Geographic Channel. I talk about it every now and then. It's certainly not my favorite show because it's positive or encouraging or entertaining or humorous. Rather, it's probably the most sobering reminder on a regular basis that I am only ever one addiction away from a total life collapse. That's true for all of us. We're all only one addiction away, one substance, one habit, one activity away from a total life collapse. Men and women, young and old, rich and poor, religious or not, are all affected by this in some way. Whether it's family members or friends, whether it's addiction's effect on society in general, and the burden that we all have to bear to pay for it, we are all affected by addiction. Now, some begin to use because they're looking for the next exciting adventure. They're bored. They've tried everything else. They've done everything else. Other people get sucked into the world of drugs or alcohol or pornography because they're trying to hide from their problems. Still others unwittingly get pulled into the world of addiction because of somebody else. Prescription drug abuse, for example. It's not necessarily your fault that you're addicted to prescription drugs, though at some point you did have an initial choice to make. But perhaps you were prescribed something by a doctor and that turned into an addiction over time when you used and then abused those prescription drugs. So whether we're talking about drugs themselves or other addictive activities, alcohol, pornography, gambling, overeating, overshopping, whatever it is, the end result for the addiction is essentially the same. Turn to 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 19. Notice this passage in 2 Peter 2 verse 19 where Peter writes, "For by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved." Now what's really interesting about that passage, among many other things that are interesting, is that word enslaved. Our English word addiction actually comes from the Latin word for enslaved or bound to something. So I find it interesting that as we talk about addiction today, it is essentially slavery to something. And here's the Apostle Peter, something that by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved. By this he is addicted. Addiction is very much a biblical topic, but it is also very much a topic of medicine, biology, and yes, choice. Let's talk a little bit here, and I won't spend too much time on this because I know that you're not here for a lecture on brain chemistry, but let's talk for a little while about just what makes addiction happen. What is the cause of addiction? Aside from, again, the initial choice that you and I have to make when it comes to these addictive activities, what's actually going on inside of your brain that perpetuates the perceived need to continue doing something that proves to be self-destructive and destructive to your relationships, your professional life, your marriage, and everything else. Well, first of all, addicts experience a flood of dopamine. Dopamine, of course, is a chemical in your brain that produces feelings of euphoria, feelings of joy. It's associated with your pleasure center, with reward. So addicts experience this flood of dopamine into their nucleus accumbens, which is also called your brain's pleasure center. The hippocampus, which is a part of your brain that helps manage your long-term memory, lays down memories of this rapid sense of satisfaction that you derive, thereby creating a connection in your memory between the drug and its effects. Your hippocampus is basically saying, when you do that, it feels really, really good. And I'm going to log that away and remember that when you do that, it feels really, really good. The amygdala, which is another part of your brain that helps process memories, then processes this conditioned emotional response to that stimulation. And this is where the desire comes from, the desire to keep on doing the addictive behavior. Not only do you have the initial flood of dopamine that makes you feel really happy, and not only does your memory then log that away as something to be recalled later, but there's also an emotional connection there as well. There is a deep satisfaction that comes from partaking of the addictive behavior or substance. Now remember, this isn't just about drugs. This is about a lot of other things as well. A number of studies have shown that those who are addicted to cocaine, meth, overeating, and pedophilia are all affected in the same way. MRI studies have shown that the brain is measurably affected by all of those things. So whether you're addicted to pornography or heroin, whether you're an overeater or an overshopper, addiction itself has the same impact on your brain, regardless of what the addiction actually is. Normally, rewards come with time and effort. You feel that dopamine rush when you put in a good hard workout. You put the effort in, and that's the reward then. The rush of joy comes when you put the time into a hobby or an activity, and it finally pays off. The paycheck after a long week of work. So normally, our brains don't receive that dopamine rush until we've put some effort in. Drugs provide a reliable and fast way to shortcut the effort that we're supposed to put in. So instead of putting in a long week at work and getting a paycheck at the end of it, we can take a hit of a drug and we get the same effect. Instead of building up relationships over time, keeping our promises, keeping our covenants, living through the hard days as well as the good, a pornography addiction gives us the same rush that a satisfying marriage might, but just in a very quick and unsatisfying sort of way in the long run. That's the problem with addiction. Addiction short-circuits the reward center of your brain. You're supposed to work for your pleasure. I think that's something in life that as you grow older and more mature, you learn is such a valuable part of our natural biology, is we are supposed to earn our pleasure in life. We are supposed to work for our rewards in life because they're not really rewards unless you earn them. Addiction destroys that. Addiction breaks that down. And when you practice addictive behaviors or substances, it ends up overwhelming the pleasure center in your brain. It produces over time less and less dopamine, or it simply eliminates dopamine receptors altogether. It's the same thing that happens when you listen to music too loud over a long period of time. The more you listen to that loud music, the less you're actually able to hear things. So you have to keep turning up the volume on the stereo to get the same effect over time. But as you're turning up the volume on the stereo, you're actually contributing to continued hearing loss. The more you practice an addictive behavior, the less satisfying the behavior gets over time because your brain is simply overwhelmed. It's telling you, turn down the volume. I can't handle this anymore. Eventually, the pleasure subsides And all we have left are the imprinted memories. That's where the hippocampus and the amygdala come in. You're not receiving, producing, or processing the dopamine anymore, but your brain is still saying, hey, this is supposed to be fun. The last time we did this, it felt really, really good. How come it's not doing it anymore? How come it's not feeling good? The memory of the pleasure is there, but the dopamine isn't doing anything any longer. And that's why we have this compulsive, self-destructive behavior. Now, with all that being said, does this mean that we don't have choice in the matter? That addiction is just a disease and that's all it is, and we can just blame our brains and blame our bodies, or blame our doctors, or blame the drug dealer, or blame the pornographer? Is that all we have then when it comes to addiction? Well, obviously, in a sense, we make choices all along the way that end up leading to addiction. The little choices that we make every day that destroy our relationships, the little choices that we make every day that affect our finances, all of these little choices lead us eventually to an addictive state. So we have to be really, really careful not to blame just the brain or the body or society when we had a choice in the matter all along. The physical consequences are just that. They're consequences. They're consequences. Addiction doesn't remove free will, but I will say it makes it harder. What addiction does to your brain, physically speaking, makes it harder for you spiritually in your will to resist later on. And that's simply a consequence. I think maybe one other way we could look at it is, I could drive drunk and lose my legs in a car accident. That is a physical consequence that will always be with me then. For the rest of my life, I'll have to live with a physical consequence that makes my life harder. And addiction is the same way. There's a physical, chemical consequence to the choices that you make. And it makes your life harder. Keep reading in 2 Peter chapter 2. We've already read in verse 19 that by what a man is overcome, by this he is enslaved, by this he is addicted. Notice verses 20 through 22 now. For after they have escaped the defilements of the world by the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So he's saying there, when you live by the will of God, that helps to shape your will by knowledge. You know Jesus, you choose to do the right thing. That is a mental decision. That is a will. But it goes on to say here, they are again entangled to them and are overcome, which sadly is the state of most addicts. The last state has become worse for them than the first. For it would be better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than having known it to turn away from the holy commandment delivered to them. It has happened to them according to the true proverb, a dog returns to its own vomit and a sow after washing returns to wallowing in the mire. And again, I think that there's a connection here. I think that what Peter has to say in the Bible is exactly what scientists today have to say about the brain and its chemistry. That the more you do something, the harder it is to break from that activity. The more you do something, the more overwhelmed you get. The more desensitized you become. The more often you go back to an activity, the harder it is to say no the next time. That's exactly what Peter is saying. You had an opportunity to turn away from the defilements of the world. You had a chance to break free from that. But you went back. Like a pig going back to the mud. Like a dog slurping up his vomit. You went back to it. And the more you go back, the harder it is to stop. So let's talk about a few of the attitudes that we have toward addiction. Maybe there are some problems that we have to face in our own lives or as a congregation to confront this problem. I'll say this is a conversation that we need to have. If this is something that you hope we would just avoid all this time because you're a shopaholic or an overeater or you have a secret pornography addiction, you know, it's easy, by the way, it's really easy and convenient for us to talk about alcoholism because the Bible is pretty conspicuous about alcohol use. The Bible has a lot to say about that. So we can do a sermon about drinking and everybody's okay with it. We'll pat ourselves on the back and say, that's right, preacher. You talk about those drunkards. You mention all those verses about drunkards. There aren't a lot of verses about pornography, though, so that's an easy sin to kind of tuck away in the pocket and pretend like it's not a big problem. And there's not a whole lot of verses about shopping too much or racking up incredible amounts of debt. So it's easy for us to hide that one away as well. We've got to confront this, though. This is a conversation we absolutely must have. 7 million Americans suffer from prescription drug abuse. 7 million Americans suffer from prescription drug abuse. Over 7 million Americans are currently addicted or abusing illicit drugs. And get this, over 4 million of those 7 million are abusing marijuana. So don't tell me that marijuana is some kind of innocent medicine. 4 million people out of 7 million illicit drug abusers are abusing marijuana. Countless individuals suffer from pornography addiction. It is a $1 billion industry, after all. And how many of us consider overeating to be an off-limits topic when it comes to what the preacher wants to talk about on a given Sunday? Even though excessive sugar can have some of the same effects on the brain as heroin, and poor diet is the great silent killer of our time, as a poor diet is directly related to heart disease, many types of cancer, stroke, and type 1 diabetes. So why do we give in? Why do we become addicts in our own way? What is really at the core of addiction? Not merely the physiological reasons why it is perpetuated, but the initial spiritual problems that introduce it. Recently, the Powerball hit a record. About $1.5 billion was the jackpot. Now, that was split up between, I believe, three different winners, so no single person won that $1.5 billion. But boy, it made the news for sure. And I don't think there's anybody here who, at least in the back of their mind, let's not be so prudish that we can't just admit that somewhere in the back of your mind, you were also going, boy, what would I do with $1.5 billion? We all had that little, we had the thought, we all had that conversation with our spouse in the car. What would you do with $1.5 billion? The interesting thing about that much money, or really any amount of money at all, is that nobody will ever be satisfied with having that much. Just like a float in a toilet tank rises and falls with the water level, so our ability to be satisfied in life rises and falls with our economic level. If you had $1.5 billion, you'd probably be euphoric at first. But eventually, $1 billion is just $1 billion. A house is a house. A toilet is a toilet, whether it's gold-plated or not. And we get used to those things in life. When you make more money, you buy the bigger house and you have the nicer car, but you get used to those things. You buy the new car, and how long does it take, especially with kids, to spill something or scratch something or scuff something, and then it's not a new car anymore. And you become covetous or envious of somebody else's new car. A Forbes.com article a couple years ago talked about the way that there was a dramatic jump in happiness for those who won the lottery, but it was only a temporary jump in happiness. And that after a certain period of time, their level of happiness, the lottery winner's level of happiness, leveled off and was about as happy as everybody else who didn't win the lottery. And the Bible teaches the same principle in Ecclesiastes 5 and verse 10. The writer of Ecclesiastes had this to say, "He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves abundance with his income." Look at that verse really carefully. And notice two things that don't ever seem to go together. According to this verse, abundance and satisfaction. Those are two things that don't go together. Abundance and satisfaction. Proverbs 27 and verse 20. Sheol and Abaddon, the grave is what he means by that. The grave is never satisfied, nor are the eyes of men ever satisfied. No matter how much we pursue a thing, satisfaction always seems to elude us. Once we grasp the thing that we want, once we grasp the thing that gives us that much pleasure or that much joy, the ecstasy quickly fades and the intensity level must be ratcheted up. That's why I never buy it when people talk about drugs or other activities and say this is as far as it will ever get. Yes, I look at pornography, but I don't look at hard, violent pornography for now. Sure, I smoke pot every now and then. What's the big deal? It's non-carcinogenic. It doesn't hurt you. What's the big deal? All I do is smoke a little pot every now and then to help me relax and manage stress. For now. So who cares if I max out my one credit card? What's the big deal? Everybody maxes out their credit card every now and then, right? Well, it's one credit card maxed out. For now. That's the thing about addiction is you're always having to ratchet up the level. It always has to be more and more and more extreme as you participate in it. Addiction is a lot like trying to quench your thirst with salt water. The more you drink, the deeper into thirst you go. The less it satisfies you. Now, it should seem obvious to us that all sins produce the same basic restlessness in us. One is never satisfied with the short-term pleasure of pornography, or the feeling of calm or excitement from various kinds of drugs, or the temporary release of stress through a violent outburst towards somebody like your spouse. All of those things are a waste of time in the pursuit of meaningful, real contentment because they never address the core issue, which is godliness. It's godliness. You'll never be satisfied with those things because they never produce godliness in your life. Go to 1 Timothy chapter 6. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, beginning in verse 3, notice what he has to say here. If anyone advocates a different doctrine and does not agree with sound words, those of our Lord Jesus Christ, and with the doctrine conforming to godliness, he is conceited and understands nothing. But he has a morbid interest in controversial questions and disputes about words, out of which arise envy, strife, abusive language, evil suspicions, and constant friction between men of depraved mind, deprived of the truth, who suppose that godliness is a means of gain. But look what he says here in verse 6. Now, I know he's not talking directly to the abuser of a drug or the pornography addict. That's not what he's talking about here in the context. But look what he has to say in verse 6. But godliness actually is a means of great gain when accompanied by contentment. Contentment is never found in having more and more and more. Contentment is never found by being more extreme with our behaviors or going deeper into an activity. Contentment is found in godliness. And you'll never find godliness in having a bad temper. And you'll never find godliness in letting your lusts run wild. You'll never find godliness in escaping from the problems of the world through drugs or alcohol. You'll never find godliness at the end of those roads, which is why you'll never find contentment at the end of those roads either. Only godliness can give us the real escape from the restlessness that we feel in life. Look what Jesus has to say in John chapter 4. A beautiful passage here. In John chapter 4, look what Jesus has to say, the promise of verses 13 and 14. Everyone who drinks of this water shall thirst again, the water that was in the well. Talking to the Samaritan woman at the well, says, those who drink of this water, the physical water, they'll thirst again. Now, it's not a sin, obviously, to drink water. It's not an addiction, necessarily, to drink water. Otherwise, we're all addicted to drinking water. But look what he has to say here in verse 14. But whoever drinks of the water that I shall give him shall never thirst again. The water that I shall give him shall become in him a well of water springing up to eternal life. Now, nothing that the world can offer you can do the same thing or produce the same result. Too much of anything, no matter how benign it seems, can actually become a bad thing. Just ask the writer of Proverbs, who says in Proverbs 25, verse 16, have you found honey? Certainly not a sin. It's not wrong to eat honey. We all love honey. In fact, honey has been a really, really good cough suppressant in our household the last couple weeks. But have you found honey, he asks. Eat only what you need, lest you have it in excess and vomit it. Even something innocent like honey can become a bad thing when it is abused. Now, our bodies are very amazing. Our brains, our five senses, all of the messages that we take in from the different parts of our body and the outside stimulation, it's all meant to help us regulate what is right and what is wrong, what we need and what we don't need, when we've had enough and when we've had too much. And it's important that we listen to the messages of our body. Our bodies are masterfully created things that are designed to know how much is enough. We receive different messages from different parts of our body that are informing us when we've exercised too hard, when we've eaten too little or too much, when we've punished a system nearly to its breaking point. And that's the same with our pleasure center in our brain. Our pleasure centers can only handle so much. And when we do something that short circuits that pleasure center, it overwhelms it and it breaks it down. And what are our bodies supposed to do with all of that pleasure that did not come with any effort, with any labor? We don't see it as a reward any longer. The system is overloaded. We push the system beyond its capacity so that we're no longer able to enjoy pleasure anymore. It is often said of addicts that the deeper they get into their addiction, the more they want to partake of the drug. Not because the drug makes them feel great anymore, and not even because the drug makes them feel good. They just want to partake of the drug so they stop feeling bad. That is a system that has been completely overloaded. I've often wondered of King Solomon. How did he end up with 700 wives and 300 concubines? For the guy who wrote Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 9, to love life with the woman who you love all the days of your fleeting life because this is your reward, how can a man who wrote that verse, or in Proverbs chapter 5 verses 15 through 23, to love the woman of your youth, that she is yours to love, she is yours to be enraptured by. How can a man who wrote those two passages have married 700 wives and had 300 concubines? That doesn't make sense to me. And if you're looking for a great biblical example of the man who went overboard and overloaded his system, I suspect you have to look no further than Solomon. With a touch of embarrassment, I believe, Solomon said in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and verse 8 that he could have had anything that he wanted, including sexual partners. Anything he wanted, he got. Anything he desired was his. The pleasures of men, he says in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. And again, I think if you interpret a certain way, I think he's got a touch of embarrassment there. He was embarrassed by the excess in his life. And he's a great case in point of a man who had everything but could never be satisfied with any of it. And at the end of his life, what could Solomon say except vanity of vanities? All is vanity. The Bible has a lot to say about self-indulgence, in fact. When we take something that's good, that God has given us to be enjoyed, and we abuse it and we push it and we overload ourselves. The Bible has a lot to say about self-indulgence. You don't find the word addiction in the Bible. But let me give you some passages that certainly address the heart behind addiction. Notice Ephesians chapter 2, verse 3. Open up to Ephesians because we're going to notice chapter 4, verse 19 as well. Go to Ephesians 2, verse 3. He says, among them we too all formerly lived in the lusts of our flesh, indulging the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and we were by nature children of wrath, even as the rest. Look at the link there. When we indulged in the fleshly desires of the mind and the body, the more we indulged, the more it affected our nature. When he says that we were by nature children of wrath, he's not saying that we were born a certain way, that it is our born nature to be a certain way. That is the kind of nature that comes by habit. It's a learned nature. That the more we indulged in the fleshly things of the world, the more it changed our nature. It affected our attitudes. It affected our chemistry. Go to chapter 4 and verse 19. He says this of those who have indulged in sin, that they, having become callous, have given themselves over to sensuality for the practice of every kind of impurity with greediness. Same idea there. It's the same idea. Where did the calloused come from? We became calloused because we gave ourselves over to every form of sensuality and the practice of impurity with greediness. What does it mean to be calloused? It needs to stop feeling. The callus is on your feet. The callus is on your fingertips. It means to stop feeling. And when you indulge, whether it's a drug or an addictive behavior, you make yourself into Ephesians 4:19. You have become calloused. And your two choices are either stop altogether or go deeper into the addictive behavior. But Romans 16 and verse 18, Romans 16 verse 18, Paul describes men who are slaves of their own appetites, he says. Slaves of their own appetites. Titus 3 and verse 3 similarly uses the term enslaved to various lusts and pleasures. How do you become enslaved to various lusts and pleasures? Jeremiah 6 and verse 15, one of the more memorable passages from the book of Jeremiah. In Jeremiah 6 and verse 15, he says, were they ashamed of the sins they committed? No, they were not ashamed. They didn't even know how to blush anymore. They had become so calloused from the sins they had committed, they didn't even know how to feel bad anymore. They couldn't even blush in embarrassment anymore. It's one of my favorite things, at least, or one of the most eye-opening aspects of that show, Drugs, Inc., is to listen to those being interviewed, the drug users and the drug dealers as well, and to just hear them say, I have no embarrassment anymore. I shoot up heroin in public, in a city park. I don't care who's looking. I don't care who knows. I have no shame anymore. People who give themselves over to every kind of idolatrous practice, to every kind of insensitive, sensual practice. People who give themselves over to harlotry so they can pay for the next fix. I don't care anymore, they always say. All I care about is the next fix. The last passage that we'll look at is Isaiah 56, verses 11 through 12. And notice in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah 56, verses 11 through 12, speaking of the calloused and empty nature of those who indulge in sin, come, they say, let us get wine, and let us drink heavily of strong drink, and tomorrow will be like today, only more so. Perhaps there's no other passage in the Bible that so sums up addiction than that. We don't care anymore. We're not embarrassed anymore. We have no shame and no pride. Come, let us partake of our addiction. And tomorrow will be just like today, only worse. Ideally, we should be preventing the spiritual problems that lead to addiction in the first place. We need to be avoiding the spiritual conditions that initiate addiction in our lives. The dissatisfaction that we feel, jealousy of somebody else's success or happiness, boredom, idle hands are the devil's workshop after all, anxiety and stress, or a sense of rebellion. We read in James chapter 3, beginning in verse 13, going on into James chapter 4. There's two divergent paths, two kinds of wisdom. There's the wisdom of the world that leads to jealousy and strife and self-destruction. There's the wisdom of God that leads us to heaven. What is your spiritual life like right now? Are you a prime target for addiction? Does Satan look at your life and your spiritual condition and see a potential candidate for the next person to overdose, for the next person to have a ruined marriage because of pornography, for the next person to ruin his or her life, to ruin his or her kid's future because of the way that you spend money, because of the way that you eat, because of the way that you talk and act and live? But when addiction does take hold, there's no easy answer. And there is no religious silver bullet either. Sitting down and talking to me might be a good first step, but there's only so much that my counseling can do. We need to stop making excuses and seek real help. Sometimes that means professional help. We'll address this next week. So I hope that you're willing to continue talking about this difficult subject with me for one more lesson, while we seek some of the solutions to the attitudes that prevent us from getting the help that we need. Now, if you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Now is your opportunity to make things right with God by obeying His words. As He cries out to you through the gospel, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved." Mark 16, verse 16. So whatever needs you might have, please come forward as we stand and sing.